Welcome back to Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. From fingerprints to DNA, forensic science has become a mainstay of our legal system, not to mention the foundation of hit TV shows. Obviously, the CSI version of forensics isn't entirely realistic. For starters, it takes a lot longer than half an hour to get almost any meaningful test result. But it turns out that even real-life forensic science may not work the way we've assumed. A new investigation finds that faulty forensics may be behind an unsettling number of wrongful convictions. Mian Crist is writer-in-residence in biological sciences at Columbia University and co-author with Tim Riekwarth of a special investigation called The Crisis of American Forensics, which appears as the cover story on the February 26th edition of The Nation. Mian, welcome to Living Lab Radio.
Hi, thank you.
Your story begins with the case of several bombings in a small Colorado mining town in the early 1990s. Is that where your investigation began? And if so, why?
Yeah, our investigation actually began with the idea of forensics. And then this case came our way, and we realized it was a really great way to dive into the problems with forensics, because in this case, Jimmy Genrich was convicted on what was actually a lot of circumstantial evidence. He had a history of mental illness. There were some fuses that were found in his toolbox that were similar but not necessarily the same as the fuses that were found in these bombs. He had some electrical training, so he could have built the bombs, but this was a town of, you know, miners and ranchers, and people knew how to do things with electronics. A lot of people had these parts. So none of that was really convincing. The thing that ended up, really putting him in jail was the fact that he had tools in his toolbox that a forensic examiner matched to scratch marks found on bomb fragments collected at the scene of the crime. And this was really the only physical evidence that linked him to the crime. And it turns out that it's not really scientifically sound. It hasn't been proven that a forensic examiner can, to 100% certainty, match tool marks to specific marks.
You actually found evidence of scientific challenges to this idea of pattern matching. And in fact, one of the lawyers in this case actually brought that up and tried to call into question this entire science of pattern matching, particularly with regard to tools. That didn't really work out, though.
Yeah, so Burton Islanik, who was the original public defender on this case, was really incredibly sort of forward-looking and forward-thinking. And it was partly because she had studied chemistry and had worked in science labs and sort of understood statistics and basic scientific methodology. And so, as any good defense lawyer does when you are presented with evidence, she sort of tried to understand it. And she went and looked for the scientific papers that would back up the claims that this examiner was making, and they just weren't there. And she kept looking and realized, you know, there really wasn't the science to prove that this technique was a reliable technique. And at the time, she was kind of a voice in the wilderness. You know, no one was using this as a defense. This evidence had been accepted into court for decades, and judges had been using precedent in previous cases to continue admitting the evidence. And so she was the first one to say, hey, I think this entire field might be really shaky. And that's a really hard defense to mount. Cut to decades later, Genrich has been in prison for nearly 25 years. And in 2009, and then again in 2016, there were these major scientific reports, the first by the National Academy of Sciences and the second by PCAST, which is the scientific advisory committee that's for President Obama. And these two reports came out that sort of did the work that Nislanik was sort of trying to do decades earlier, and they did these really systematic reviews, not only of tool marks, or they actually didn't specifically look at tool marks. They looked more at firearm and other kinds of pattern matching things, but they found there was no scientific research and no scientific foundation for the claims that forensic examiners were making in court. So now Genrich's case is up on appeal because at the time of his first trial, these major reports didn't exist. You know, the PCAST report and the NAS report and the voice of the scientific community saying this is a problem, these forensic sciences are maybe not science.
I'm talking with journalist Mian Crist of Columbia University about her investigation into forensic science. you've said that those reports call into question the whole idea of forensic science. Let's be specific. Are there scientific methods? What about fingerprinting? What about DNA? Are there methods that actually do hold up scientifically, or are you really impugning all forensic science?
A lot of forensic science is completely valid. You know, things like forensic chemistry, things like DNA analysis. There are things that are based in known, scientifically tested, empirical data about the world, right? So we know things about how chemicals interact. We know things about the human genome, and we can use what we know and apply it to forensics and apply it to court cases. Things that are really in question here are what are called the pattern matching disciplines. So, you know, things like, you know, comparing bullets fired from a gun to bullets that were left at a crime scene, comparing things like fingerprints. You know, when these reports went and looked around, they found what they called a community in disarray in terms specifically of these pattern matching disciplines. So, you know, depending on what state a crime lab happened to be in, the numbers of points of comparison needed to declare a match were different. You know, depending on where the lab work was being done, some labs were accredited, others were not. The accreditation was not uniform across different labs and across different states. You know, forensic examiners have very different levels of training. It just didn't look at all like science.
When you add all of that up, do we have a good sense of how much of an impact faulty forensic science is having on the actual outcome of trials, and how many trials are being affected by this?
It's really hard to calculate wrongful conviction rates, but academics who study this issue suggest it's somewhere between 2 to 7%. So given that the population of incarcerated people in the U.S. is over 2 million, that would mean somewhere between 40,000 to 150,000 wrongfully convicted people are currently in prison. So according to the Innocence Project, faulty forensic science is a factor in about half of wrongful convictions. And there are more conservative estimates and studies that have been done by the National Registry of Exonerations and from academics who peg that number closer to 24 to 34%. So however you crunch the numbers, we're talking about thousands of people incarcerated based at least in part on evidence that was presented to juries as if it's proven science when it actually hasn't been tested and proven.
There's a lot of wiggle room in those numbers that you just mentioned, right? Mm-hmm. A lot of very divergent estimates of how widespread wrongful convictions based on faulty forensic science actually are. And in fact, there are those in the legal system who say this is not a problem at all. Mm-hmm. What, if anything, is being done at this point to address this issue?
I mean, after these reports came out, there was some movement toward reform. So a lot more labs are accredited now than used to be accredited. Some labs have been shut down. But the sort of movement toward reform really slowed down when Trump became president. There was an organization that was set up, the National Commission on Forensic Science. It was a multidisciplinary body that included, you know, forensic experts and lawyers and scientists, prosecutors. Everyone was sort of coming together to try and figure out standards for the field at a national level, which, you know, the American criminal justice system is not controlled by the national level. You know, we have state legal systems, but certainly what happens at the national level sets the tone for what happens around the country. And these recommendations included things like dropping the phrase "to a reasonable degree of scientific certainty" from examiner testimony because it had become clear that was scientifically not supportable. And then you had people on this committee like Ted Hunt who opposed most of those reforms. So when Trump became president, Jeff Sessions became head of the DOJ, and Jeff Sessions chose Ted Hunt to lead what is now nominal reform efforts inside the DOJ. They allowed that commission that was interdisciplinary to expire, and they have sort of moved all reform efforts under the auspices of the DOJ, which presents a huge conflict of interest as the culture of prosecution is not consistent with a culture of science.
You mentioned, you know, the culture of prosecution versus the culture of science. There's also I mean, I think you could argue that both law and science in their own ways are extremely rigorous fields, but you've kind of got the standards of the two juxtaposed in interesting, but maybe not helpful ways in this case. I mean, you go back, trace the history of forensic science being used in court cases all the way back to this one case, Frye versus the U.S., 70, 80 odd years ago. What is the standard in the legal system for what evidence can be admitted? And you've kind of touched on this a little bit. And how does that compare to maybe what would be a scientific standard for what evidence should be admitted?
That's a great, great question, because we're talking about two different systems of knowledge. And a scientific system is based on empirical methods that have been tested over many years. And there are certain requirements, you know, for example, for the ways that studies get set up and the ways that, you know, the scientific disciplines accept data and accept conclusions and accept theory. The legal system has a different kind of logic, and it is reaching towards truth in a way that is similar to the scientific system, but is actually deeply different. So the idea is that you can bring evidence into a courtroom, and fundamentally you are sort of laying things out and letting a jury decide, right? The jury can decide whether or not they think this evidence is convincing. The jury can decide whether or not they think this science is sound, which goes against principles of science in the sense that you want to not present something until you have already decided that it is sound. And so when you're talking about forensic evidence, there are certain standards in the judicial system that do not, in fact, vet for scientific reliability, often because you have experts coming in and giving their opinion about whether or not something is science and whether or not it's reliable. And sometimes those are the very experts who have designed the techniques, whose livelihoods depend on those techniques. And even if everyone's acting in good faith, you may have experts who are biased in the evidence that they are offering, and you have judges who are not scientifically trained, and they're not qualified to actually evaluate whether or not something is science. And so you get evidence that enters into the legal system that has never really been vetted as science. It has been vetted according to these other standards of evidence that do not, in fact, keep junk science out of courtrooms.
Meehan Crist is writer in residence in biological sciences at Columbia University and co-author with Tim Requarth of a special investigation, The Crisis of American Forensics, that appears as the cover story of the February 26th edition of The Nation. Meehan, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
And that's our show. Until next week, this is Living Lab Radio. You can connect with us on Facebook and Twitter. I'm Heather Goldstone. Thanks for listening.
Living Lab Radio is produced by WCAI in Woods Hole and WGBH Radio in Boston. It's produced by me, Elsa Partan, and Heather Goldstone is executive producer. Funding for Living Lab Radio comes from the Candida Fund, investing in transformative leaders and ideas. Theme music by Stellwagen Symphonette.